This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello and a very happy Thursday afternoon to you. Today you're going to find out about some new technology that's being used in the shearing shed. This is all about preventing injuries to shearers. Some researchers have been working on this for a while and they've come up with something. You'll find out about that after 12:30 today. And also a little more information for you about how you and your community might be able to get your hands on some wild dog grant money that's available. You just have to come up with the right project and let them know about the situation at your place, and then you might be one of those groups that get your hands on some of that money. That is not too far away here on the Country Hour. It is 12:06, and the livestock export ship chartering company, Wellard, has struck a deal to sell the world's largest purpose-built livestock vessel, which is the MV Ocean Shearer, for just over $77 million. The sale is an attempt to try and fix the company's finances. The ship is going to be bought by one of the largest exporters of sheep from Australia to the Middle East. It's the Kuwaiti company Al Mawashi Limited, which trades here in Australia as the Kuwait Livestock Transport and Trading Company, the KLTT. John Klepek is Wellard's executive chairman. John Klepek, why does a livestock vessel chartering company want to sell one of the world's largest purpose-built livestock vessels?
We want to sell. Well, we have sold the what we consider the best ship in the livestock fleet in the world's livestock fleet because it completes our capital restructure for our company. We have been heavily burdened by excessive debt levels for a period of time, and selling this ship to a company that will not be directly competing against our other vessels makes economic sense for us.
How busy has the shearer been throughout the year, 2019?
Well, vastly different. For the first 8 months of the year, because of the closure of the turkey trade, it didn't complete any trades at all. It was at anchor. Since then, we've completed two shipments in Turkey, and we've repositioned it to Australia and in the process of completing a multi-exporter shipment to Indonesia currently, which we followed up with a shipment into Vietnam. And then the transaction with the KLTT will proceed after that shipment to Vietnam.
Why wasn't it used very much after that sort of South American Turkey trade route closed suddenly?
It wasn't used because of the sheer demand and supply in the market. We are a shipping company. There's only so many head of cattle or sheep to export at any given time. And if there are a surplus number of vessels in the market, the turkey market is a significant market. And we were not the only company that was impacted by the closure of the turkey market. Having said that, the market changes. The demand in the market now is quite good in terms of the sheep exporting from Australia. The demand into the Middle East is very high. There are other shipments. The turkey market is, however, extremely volatile. Although it's reopened, the traders over there are not don't have access to the market or import or permits year-round. So it is, has reopened, but it is volatile. So basically a supply-demand equation.
Well, the vessel, it's currently en route to Darwin and is set to make a voyage to Indonesia. Does this mark its first ever Australian job for the shearer?
Yes, it does. And the other interesting fact there is it has five livestock exporters with cattle on the ship. So it's the first vessel with so many, as far as I'm aware, first with that number of exporters sharing the same vessel. And it is our first trade from Australia. Shearer has been predominantly on the turkey trade, so there hasn't been a demand for it into Australia. But we saw that was changing and took advantage of opportunities that presented themselves to reposition it here and trade from Australia on a multi-party basis.
Just catching up with John Klepek, Wellard's executive chairman, talking about the fact the company has now sold the MV Ocean Shearer for just over $77 million. John Klepek, the KLTT, the Kuwait Livestock Transport and Trading Company, has purchased the Shearer. Do you know what routes it plans to use for the vessel?
Our understanding is for the Fremantle to Kuwait trade for their operations that are in Kuwait and and into the Middle East. So predominantly Fremantle sheep to or WA Western Australian sheep to the Middle East.
And the KLTT did have a ship that was under construction until the boat builder went broke. So I guess Wellard was aware that KLTT was in the market for a vessel. Is it a good deal for KLTT?
I think it's a fair deal for both parties. They require a ship that will deliver the outcomes which are the expectations of the Australian public in regards to animal welfare. And in terms of commercial aspects of it, I think it's when two parties reach agreement, I think it's always fair on fair and reasonable terms.
In October, Wellard settled the sale and lease back of the ship, the Ocean Swagman, for $32 million. 2 years after selling the Ocean Outback for $34.9 million. So my understanding is now Wellard has three vessels. That's a Swagman, the one that you've leased back for 3 years,
yep.
The Ute and the Drover.
Yep.
But it was just mid last year, the Drover was for sale. So is it still for sale?
No.
Why is that?
There's no requirement to sell the Drover. We believe there's the earnings from the Drover will be well and truly better than any alternative transaction regarding the Drover.
And so what routes will those, the three that you now have, what routes will they be undertaking looking forward?
Smaller ships, the Swagman and the Ute, will be the same as they currently do, which are predominantly cattle from Australia to the Southeast Asian areas, both slaughter cattle, feeder cattle, and also breeder cattle into China. They will continue to operate that. Drover will be a mixture of those, plus sheep to the Middle East, plus voyages to Europe, plus voyages to, Europe being Russia and also to Turkey. But some of those are not from Australia. They may be sourced from Brazil.
So what does the future hold for Wellard? How's 2020 shaping up?
Pretty good. With the Ocean Shearer sold, it does complete our capital restructure. So, you know, your previous questions on, you know, why any other ships, etc. Once the Ocean Shearer settles, there is no requirement for any other further asset sales, raising of capital, etc. We are financially robust to be able to go forward. So that's been the debt of the company has been a major millstone that has been there for years. To go going forward with only circa 16 million of US of debt, with the owning two ships and having another third one on a long-term lease arrangement, is as sound as a livestock exporter shipping company could be. So financially, we're very robust. In terms of the market, the current utilisation of the ships is good. The outlook is positive as well. The demand for the Australian cattle and Australian sheep, especially Australian sheep in the Middle East, is very high and the opportunity is large. The issue that we have to contend with to take advantage of that opportunity is the pricing, ex-farm pricing and total price delivered into those countries. There is a cost overlay of any exports into the Middle East and into our near neighbours, into Indonesia and Vietnam. And the current pricing of both cattle and sheep is at the upper end. So if there's any further movement in the pricing ex-farm, the exports are going to suffer.
John Klepek, good to have you on the WA Country Hour. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
John Klepek is the Executive Chairman of Wellard. 13 past
12. The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
If you are a farmer or a pastoralist and you've got enclosed areas of wild dog fencing, then you are able to apply for $2.25 million of funding for projects that tackle wild dogs. This is industry money, so 15 cents from the sale of every sheep and goat in Western Australia is set aside, and then those funds are used to create the Sheep and Goat Industry Funding Scheme. The scheme's chair is Charles Woss, and he says grants of up to $600,000 for wild dog activities spanning over 3 years are available.
At the moment, there's a expressions of interest out for grants of up to $600,000 over 3 years. The idea of this is to provide some funding for anywhere where there are gaps in the system. So for those areas that are having trouble with dogs and current funding opportunities aren't meeting their needs, and there's a problem with wild dogs in the area that's affecting the sheep and goat industry, and we've sort of made some funds available to hopefully fill those gaps and help out people in the industry.
Now, I noticed with some information that came out about this, it talks about these are for activities to support the eradication of wild dogs within fenced areas. What does that mean?
It's important that we certainly take note that it is within the state barrier fence. It gives us a line to work back on from within that area. Outside that area, it is significantly more difficult, and you know a lot of the pastoralists will tell you, to get a lot of traction with the dogs because there's no line to work back against.
Okay, so this basically is excluding the pastoral industry. This is what we would traditionally call farming country. That's for these types of areas.
There are some fenced cells within the pastoral industry, and so they come under that fenced area.
What about if those cells are still under construction? Would they be eligible?
Probably not. It is within a fence, so the fence needs to be there.
Okay. All right. So maybe next year when cells like the Murchison vermin cell, that's a big one that's being built, they might not be eligible this round, but maybe next year from what you're saying, when it's done.
Yeah, and that's why we're calling for expressions of interest. The committee don't claim to be experts on where the gaps are and what is needed. So we're asking, you know, the people that are on the ground what their issues are, what areas we need to be looking at, and then, you know, that call for expression of interest, and then those expressions of interest can be reviewed as to whether they meet the criteria or not.
And what are some of the work that they could be potentially using this money for? What are some of the examples? We're talking about doggers, that sort of thing?
Yes, certainly. So I know some of the work they're doing is in areas that aren't currently covered by a regional biosecurity group, but they have started to have impacts by wild dogs. There's funds have been made available to get some on-ground support straight away, because the setting up of a biosecurity group can take some time, and it can take time for people to get, you know, a committee in place and get funding organised to be able to do things. So this makes funds available to get on-the-ground activities happening in a much more timely manner.
Now, you're farming just out of Karoo. Are you noticing wild dog activity at your place?
Fortunately, I haven't had wild dogs on my farm. However, there's definitely been, like my neighbours have, and we're not far from the Wathaurou National Park, and there's definitely been, you know, we've seen evidence of wild dogs in the national park as well. It's one of those ones where it's not yet, but at some stage.
Sheep and Goat Industry Funding Scheme Chair Charles Woss speaking to Joe Prendergast. This is the second round of grants to fill wild dog funding gaps, and the applications close on January 12. Just search Wild Dog Grants WA and it'll come up first there on the search for you. This is the Country Hour. And 18 past 12. Still staying with the dogs for a little bit longer, because the Pilbara Regional Biosecurity Group says a 12-month trial employing three doggers in the region has really helped do something about the rising number of wild dogs in the north of the state. This year, more than 300 dogs have been trapped or shot, and doggers have put out about 70,000 targeted baits across 15 stations just in the Pilbara region. The group's executive officer is Bill Currens, and he says it's the first time in 15 years they've had full-time doggers employed on the ground.
There used to be doggers in the Pilbara when there were sheep in the Pilbara. The doggers work on the ground. They're targeting exactly where wild dogs are on pastoral stations, so they're seeing, oh, here's some tracks here. There's markings from dogs. So they're setting traps exactly where the wild dogs are moving around, exactly where they're operating in the country. And they can also shoot dogs as a control methodology, and they can also put out baits exactly where the dogs are as well. So it's quite targeted. It's very targeted work, exactly where the wild dogs are functioning in the landscape. And particularly if they're attacking cattle and calves, they can focus on those areas.
It's been a tact used by other biosecurity groups, for example, in the Gascoyne, and it seems to have been pretty successful. Why has it only been in 2019 that you've brought it back in after so long?
So the main reason is not from a lack of interest from the pastoral stations, but it's just about budget and limited funds. The Pilbara Biosecurity Group has a limited budget of around $400,000 a year. Half that comes from pastoralists and half of it comes from the state government. which is a really good sort of 50-50 matching arrangement. That budget generally covers, we do regional aerial baiting for wild dogs in September. We do some large feral herbivore control, aerial shooting using professional shooters. Between those two activities, that most of that $400,000 is gone. So for a regional baiting program and as much as we can, aerial shooting of camels, donkeys and feral horses, there's no room in that $400,000 budget for employing doggers. It costs around $100,000 a year per dogger. And we just had a gap where some funds built up. So basically those funds built up, around $100,000 was budgeted to, and with matching funds from the stations, 50-50 sort of cash deal, we generated enough budget just to trial doggers for 12 months. So it costs around $210,000, I think, for overall, I think, to have three doggers for 12 months.
It's been successful. Is it something you're going to be able to continue doing in the future?
The Pilbara RBG committee certainly wants to. We've got at least one of those doggers is now continuing in private arrangements, which is great. So the stations themselves are paying the full cost to having a dogger service in some situations, which is wonderful.
It's wonderful in one perspective for you from the group that the doggers are still active. But from a pastoralist perspective, they already pay rates. You know, yes. They already pay their pest rates. So then they're paying for the dogger as well. And they're kind of, it's a double hit.
It is. And part of that is that some stations are reporting that they're losing up to $500,000 per year from wild dog damage and attack and calf losses. So it's sort of in their interest to pay that. But areas like, talk about areas like the Gascoyne, Murchison area, the Meekatharra area, they've had doggers operating for a long time that have been funded through the pest rates, which is partial pest rates and matching state dollars. But that's been the way they've set their budget up and focused. Ideally in the Pilbara, we'd be able to generate some other funding coming in that could help subsidise those doggers again. So that helps the money go further, and if we can get some other funds coming in, we can actually have more doggers across the landscape. Stations may be putting in 50% again rather than 100%, cover more country, cover double the number of country and control more dogs. Also looking at other funding sources for our large feral herbivore control. So if we can find other sources of income for covering some of our large feral herbivore budget, it frees up a bit more for the dogger stuff.
And becoming more and more vital to the pastoral industries as the dog predation seems to be increasing.
Yeah, absolutely. The reports in the Pilbara is more and more reports of wild dog attacks. The Pastoral Land Board annual return surveys indicate that the Pilbara region is probably losing around $3 million a year from wild dog attacks and calf losses. Feedback I did a couple of questionnaires with the Pilbara stations. My estimates could be up to $5 million, so sort of between $3 million and $5 million per year of losses to the cattle industry from wild dog attacks. So that's quite a significant loss. The doggers have technology. We have set them up with tablets, and there's a feral scan app that can record, out of mobile phone service, they can record where they're putting their traps, they can record where they're trapping dogs, or they can record where they're baiting. So it's best practice technology being used out in the field, out in remote areas. When they come back in the range, that's uploaded through a national website. So we have that sort of data, and spot safety devices that can tell us exactly where they are every 10 minutes. So we've got good safety systems, but we can also look at what country they're covering and record all that information too. So, yeah, they're amazing people.
Pilbara Regional Biosecurity Executive Officer Bill Currens with Michelle Stanley. 24 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Let's get into some grains industry news now. And this harvest has certainly thrown up its fair share of challenges, from dry conditions pretty much across many areas to fairly brutal frosts in other parts of the state. And then on top of that, some grain growers in the south of the state have had to deal with snails, particularly in the canola. And things get even more complicated because the tolerance for these snails when you go to deliver your grain is really low, and it's really been tightened up this year. Derek Kerwin is a farmer from South Stirlings, which is about an hour northeast of Albany, and he says growers just have to accept these new standards. And he thinks issues with snails aren't really going anywhere. In fact, they're probably going to be around in increasing numbers.
This is the new challenge on the south coast. And, we had to do a mercy dash to South Australia and buy a snail roller. the local grain handler changed their receival standards, and I can understand why, because the customers wanted one sale snail per hectolitre, and so we had to virtually, well, we've cleaned in excess of 4,000 tonnes of grain for snail, cleaned and rolled.
So what was the previous standard before it came down to just one?
I'm pretty sure it was about 8, and there is a segregation, but it's very expensive to put your grain into that segregation. You lose too much money. So we're doing it on farm.
And I've been up there to have a look. It's quite an impressive setup there. You've got the screen machine, you've got...
Oh, yeah, no, it's extraordinary. We're really surprised with the result we're getting out of it. And I guess we've got the South Australians to thank for that. They've had to deal with this problem for some 25 years on the York Peninsula. And, yeah, their snail roller's doing a great job.
And as you say, it's gradually spreading. It's been a problem in Esperance.
Yeah, well, you know, 5 to 7 years ago, you talk to people about it and they would say, well, we haven't got them. That's suddenly changed in the last 3 years. Out through Franklin, there's a problem this year. Esperance along the south coast, it's you just never know when they're going to rear their ugly head.
Because you were saying before that, you know, you taking some measures, you would have thought that would have eased the problem, but it hasn't, whereas somebody who's done nothing hasn't got a problem.
Yeah, well, that's right. And there's certainly got to be a lot of work done in this space. You know, I know that Stirlings to Coast have a grant to do that, some of that work, but needs to be a lot of money spent on it.
Now, the very tiny snails, when Max was showing me how small they are, it must be technologically quite a difficult task to crush them and not crush your canola.
Well, I'm amazed that it actually does it. As you saw, Mark, we clean all our canola before it goes through the roller, and the snails that are in the sample are... the same size or smaller than canola, but as it goes through those two rollers, they get crushed by the canola and disappear. You can't find them in the sample, which is a good result.
So you were mentioning that it's just prevalent along the south coast at the moment, but heading further west. Could it head further north? Is what's research telling you at this stage?
Oh, well, you know, time will tell. Physically, the things will get there because you cannot get them off any machine. They will get spread, but I don't know how well they'll persist when you get as far north as places like Narrabeen, where it's a lot warmer. But certainly out through Franklin and Boyup Brook, if they haven't got them now, they're going to have them soon.
South Stirlings grower Derek Kerman with Mark Bennett talking about the snail problem. Ben McNamara manages operations for WA's main grain handler, CBH, and he says while his cooperative doesn't set the standards, it's trying to work with growers to ensure they can be met.
This year, there's probably been less of a problem than previous years. Now, we're aware that growers are spending time cleaning as well. And there's also some other activities going in to investigate what are the other, I guess, natural ways of removing some of those snails as well. So we're working with some of the grower groups on some of those aspects as well.
I know a few of the growers are worried that they will struggle to make spec. You know, even with cleaning, some of the snails are so small that they can actually be hard to remove entirely. Is CBH fixed to the standards for this year? Are they staying put? Or is there room to adjust them if growers are having problems?
So we've certainly worked with GIWA, who sets the standards on this. Yeah, listen, obviously there's some challenges, but hence the reason why we're working with some of the grower groups to identify ways to remove some of these problems, because as you said, very difficult to screen them out when they're so small.
CBH General Operations Manager Ben McNamara. 29 past 12, just before news headlines, just after the headlines, in fact, we're going through some of the rain in some of the thunderstorms forecast for parts of the state. But just before we get to the details of that, Joe Clues is at Malangada Station, which is about 500 kilometres northeast of Perth, and she says they got a nice little storm yesterday.
Yes, we had ourselves our first little storm of the season came through. So we picked up, might not be much in most people's eyes, but we picked up 5.6 millimetres yesterday afternoon. I believe there was a fair bit more dropped east of us, and I think even the Mount Magnet Yalgoo Road was floodways were running, so sounds like there was a pretty good drop east of us as well.
Oh, that's nice. Were you expecting the rain to come in?
No, not really. We've gone so long now without any that we kind of just go, oh, ho-hum, here comes another set of storm clouds and it'll probably go all around us. So, no, not really, but we probably should at this time of the year be expecting that we will get the odd storm come through.
You said that it's not unusual. Like, are you summer dominant or winter dominant for your rain there at Malangata?
It's mostly half and half. And if you miss out on one of them, unfortunately, like this year, which we missed out on the summer rains at the beginning of the year, before this 5.6, we were sitting on 167 millimetres for our total annual rainfall, and our average is usually about 235.
Oh, gosh, that hurts, doesn't it?
So if you miss out on one of them, unfortunately, you're really going to have you're going to struggle to make it up with the other one.
Jo Clues at Malangata Station near Yalgoo in WA's Murchison region. Just after news headlines and the weather, you will find out about some much bigger rainfall totals in parts of Queensland. But I'm keen to hear if it's fallen in the drought-affected parts of that state. You will find out shortly here on the Country Hour. 29 to 1, Vicky Saler is in the studio. What's making headlines, Vicky?
Thanks, Belle. Several people have told the trial of the alleged Claremont serial killer that they heard screams in the Perth suburb of Wellard in June 1996. Bradley Robert Edwards is charged with murdering Jane Rimmer at that time. Kenneth and Judith Mitchell told the court they heard a screaming female voice in the early hours of June the 9th. Ian Sturck told the court he heard something similar. The trial continues. New Zealand police say they're finalising plans to recover the remaining bodies of those killed in Monday's volcanic eruption from White Island tomorrow morning. 8 people are confirmed dead and another 8 are missing, presumed dead. The danger of another eruption has prevented recovery efforts until now. And US media are reporting Harvey Weinstein, the Hollywood film producer, accused of sexually harassing or assaulting dozens of women, has reached a $36 million civil settlement with some of his accusers. Mr. Weinstein also faces criminal charges and is scheduled to appear in court next month. I'll have more news at 1 o'clock.
Vicky, thank you for that update. 28 to 1.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Radio WA.
Between now and the news at 1, off to Boyanup today for a wrap of the cattle sale that was held yesterday. John Testrow going through the details for you. Also, some new research and some tips on keeping safe in the shearing shed, and also checking in on some of that rain that's fallen in Queensland. How useful has it been? You will find out shortly. First to the Bureau of Meteorology, and Steph Bond is on deck this afternoon. Steph, is it pretty much hot right around the state today?
Yes, apart from a very, very tiny part of the Yukiel coastline, we're looking at those temperatures being in those mid to high 40s right through the northern parts and into the Gascoyne as well, and even those low 40s reaching down through the kind of Geraldton central west area and down into the Perth metro area too. Elsewhere through the state, we're looking at high 30s today. Tomorrow, that broad trough remains right next to the coastline, so we're going to see temperatures increase even further over the southwest land division. With temperatures mostly around high 30s to early 40s and reaching right down to the south coast as well, getting up to around 35 degrees there too. Elsewhere through the state tomorrow, we're looking at some showers and storms confined to the Pilbara, the North Interior and the Kimberley district as well. That trough does remain right next to the coast. So once again, temperatures increasing even further, and temperatures will be around 12 degrees above average for most of the southern parts of the state. So we are looking at a prolonged hot spell over the next few days, particularly in the south. And elsewhere in the state, we're still looking at those hot temperatures remaining in the northern parts, up around that 40 degrees. On Saturday, storms may come down a bit further south to be over the Gascoyne as well as the northern parts of the Goldfields, pretty much north of Kalgoorlie. We may see some storms just go into the northeastern parts of the central wheat belt there, but they won't come too far south at all. So most of the southwest land division will remain sunny and hot on Saturday. Sunday, once again, the trough continues near the west coast and those hot temperatures continue. Those hot, really hot temperatures do extend eastwards into the Eucla district as well as the south interior. We may see some slightly cooler temperatures just in the Pilbara and also the Kimberley, just as that trough moves eastwards. Once again, thunderstorms mainly confined to the northern parts of the state through the Kimberley, the north interior and also the Pilbara, but also extending down further into the goldfields and maybe even reaching the Esperance coastline too. Any of these storms over the next 3 weeks apart from the Kimberley will probably be dry, so we're not expecting any precipitation out of those storms much at all.
And Steph, what about warnings this afternoon? What have you got?
Yeah, so the warning we have out there is for a fire weather warning for the severe fire dangers, and that is over the areas of the coastal central west, the interior, east Pilbara coast, east Pilbara inland, and the lower west coast as well.
Steph, thank you for the wrap. Appreciate that. This is the Country Hour on ABC WA, 24 to 1. And Richard Hudson in the studio now to go through the rainfall figures for you.
Yeah, not many again, unfortunately, even up in the north. But in the Kimberley, just the one, and that's Yulumbu, had 5 millimetres. And then just a few storms around the Gascoyne region. Coodardie had 16, Kew 18, Meekatharra at the airport 6, and Mallura had 15. And then for the entire rest of the state, just the highest was York East, had 4 mils. That's in the central wheat belt, and that was it.
ABC Local Radio Harvest Ban Information.
Yeah, due to the risk of a fire, just a few local authorities have imposed a harvest ban, so you're not allowed to harvest or use any equipment that could potentially start a fire, and that's Gingin, Kalamunda, Mundaring and Wanneroo. And the next update will be at 3:05 this afternoon.
ABC Radio, fire ban information.
Fires seem to be dominating a lot of the radio this morning, but a total fire ban affecting the Perth metropolitan region is on today. So these local government districts are Chittering, Gingin, Kalamunda, Mundaring and Swan. So at those times, you're not allowed to light, maintain or use a fire in the open air, and you can't carry out any activity that could start a fire. If a harvest and vehicle movement ban has not been implemented by your local government, you are able to harvest or move vehicles across paddocks for ag purposes, but you could be fined up to $25,000 or jailed for a year or both if you ignore the total fire ban. If you're a bit unsure about it, just do a search for DFES, D-F-E-S, and total fire ban, and you'll get all the information that you need there. But just quickly, there's also a bushfire watch and act for parts of Bullsbrook in the city of Swan. In other words, that's issued for people in an area bounded by North Avenue, Kimberley Street and Great Northern Highway in Bullsbrook in the city of Swan. There's also a bushfire watch and act for parts of Two Rocks, Eglinton and Yanchep in the city of Wanneroo. So that's issued for people bounded by Two Rocks Townsite to the north, Yanchep National Park, including Yanchep Golf Estate to the east, Eglinton to the south and Two Rocks Road and Marmion Road to the west in the city of Wanneroo. And I'm pretty sure that particular fire is about to go back up to an emergency level. If you want to know more details on that, if you have friends in the area or if you're moving towards that area, please switch over to ABC Perth or ABC 720, either on analog radio or streaming. So either ABC Perth or 720 on the dial.
Thanks for that, Richard. 21 to 1.
On ABC Radio WA, you're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour.
And as you just heard from Richard, not much rain about Western Australia in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, and doesn't look likely in the next few days or so either. But overnight, Brisbane received more than 100 millimetres of rain in 1 hour. That's the same amount of rain Brisbane has received in the last 6 months. So it's good for the city's dams and gardens, but Brisbane is not officially in drought. So did the parched farms and cattle stations in the drought-affected regions get any rain? Lydia Burton is the rural reporter based in Toowoomba, about 130 kilometres west of Brisbane. Lydia, how widespread was the rain? Good afternoon, Belle. Well, look, it was patchy rain. It was storm rain. So it really means if you're under it, fantastic. If not, you basically missed out. An example of this is Killarney, a little town on the New South Wales border in southern Queensland, measured 59 millimetres, literally kilometres up the road from the town of Killarney. There was 6 millimetres measured. So it was extremely patchy. You absolutely had to be under it. And it was really concentrated to sort of the east coast in a line, if you're familiar with Queensland, you know, sort of from Bundaberg on the coast down to the New South Wales border. Again, so it was good if you're under it. And one of those lucky people was actually Australia's biggest commercial grower of Rosella plants near Gympie. Her name is Cece Diaz. And as she says, the drenching was absolutely welcomed because it came just in the nick of time.
We probably would have added 2 inches of rain because of all the runoff, I suppose, on the side of the dam. So they could have put a bit of water, probably not that much. But the thing is, the whole farm would have been saturated overnight. You know, there was no wind. It was cooler sort of at night time, and that would have just been absorbed by the soil. And, you know, when you got crops that have been sort of limpy, and all of a sudden this morning, it's just like, it's just happy, you know, everything's just happy, the mood is happy, and the plants are happy, and it just again given us a bit more reprieve. I mean, we're only a day away from running empty on our dam, on our big holding dam, because the others are all dry. So well, we can only hope that this will create an effect that, you know, hopefully rain is really just on its way. That will just be amazing.
Cece Diaz, she's Australia's biggest commercial grower of Rosella plants. And I think, you know, as she mentioned there, this rain is very, very far from drought breaking. But what it does for your mental health, to even just hear that sound of rain on the roof, you know, money can't buy that sound.
No, you can definitely hear it in a voice too, just even that little bit. Did the Lockyer Valley get any rain, Lydia?
Well, interesting you ask. Of course, the Lockyer Valley is known as Queensland's salad bowl region, and thankfully, it actually got some of the best rain it's had in years. This is incredibly important because literally a week ago, I was in the valley talking to farmers, and they were saying the crops that you see in the ground at the moment is what they will be. After that, they're not planting because there's you know, the ground is so paddock and they're running out of water. Thankfully, though, that might change. People might head out into the paddock and start planting because of this rain. It's been so welcome that people were literally jumping for joy. There was a photo of a farmer in the Lockyer Valley, Brenton Neindorf, dancing in the rain. That's exactly how we feel. And it's doing rounds on social media. And he says, you know, as we just mentioned, it's a huge boost for morale. Take a listen.
I can't actually remember the last time we had that much rain. I think it'd be October last year. I remember the weekend of my brother's wedding. We had it on the farm and we had a fair bit of rain over the weekend and kept things very wet. But this year we haven't had anything in the likes of that. We wouldn't have had that much rain in total this year, I don't think, out of our gauges.
That's amazing. So in one fall, you've completely overrun what is the year's tally. That's sensational. What does it mean at your place? What crops have you got in the ground at the moment?
We've just got some hay crops in. We haven't got very much at all because our bore water levels at the moment are right down, so we can only pump minimal amount of water. But it's a bit of a band-aid. It'll help us short term. It'll green up what we do have. It'll help us get ready to plant some more crop and hope for a bit of follow-up rain.
It must be a happy day on the farm today. Has it boosted your morale?
Yeah, definitely. Even a few of the workers are getting around with the smiles on their face. We've got a few international guys that do their 3-month visas with us, and it's been so dry since they started, haven't seen a bit of rain, and they just thought it was pretty intense how it comes.
Brenton Neindorf, he's a farmer in Queensland's Lockyer Valley, speaking with the Queensland Country Hour presenter, Ali Felton-Taylor, there. And, you know, to give you an idea, best rain in years,
but it was just over 70 mils. But we're getting excited about anything that falls at the moment, Belle.
Oh, I can imagine that. In fact, I just want to let you know that the Lockyer Valley Farmer is up on the ABC Rural Facebook page. So if you want to go and check him out, you can go and do that when you get some time this afternoon, just on the ABC Rural Facebook page. Catching up with Lydia Burton over in Queensland today, just to get an idea of some of the rain that's fallen in parts of Queensland. And Lydia, I know your family has a property near Longreach. Did it get any rain? And what's the situation like there at the moment?
Oh, well, thanks for asking. Yeah, look, it's pretty tough out there. Unfortunately, we haven't had rain. They did get a little bit in Cyclone Trevor, which was back in February at the start of this year. But, you know, it's kind of like spitting on a fire. It didn't do much, but it was still good to have. They haven't got any at the moment. So it's pretty tough out there. In fact, if you had to imagine what my parents' property looks like, it's 25,000 acres and it looks like a paddock just before a crop goes in. It's bare, dirt, dusty. That property normally runs about 1,500 cows, and there's not an animal on it at the moment. But look, you know, their turn will come.
Yeah, I really hope so, and that you really paint that picture well of what it looks like there, and certainly hoping that turns around. What about other drought affected parts of the state?
Yeah, look, Dirranbandi, that's a pretty significant part in southern Queensland. It's sort of down on the New South Wales-Queensland border again. It's a major crop-producing area. Those guys haven't had significant rain since 2013. And in fact, I was recently down there talking to one farmer. He has a 9-year-old son, and they did get a little bit of rain back earlier this year in April, enough to get a bit of a green shoot on a sandhill. But, you know, it didn't actually do anything. But even that, his 9-year-old son said to him, "Dad, what's that over there?" And he said to his son, "That's green grass, mate." And he was nearly in tears because he thought, crikey, my son's 9 and he doesn't know what green grass looks like. So it's still very tough for a lot of Queensland at the moment with this drought. You know, that area, they haven't had a crop, summer or winter crop, for 3 years, that farmer. In fact, he told me that between 2013 and this year, he's managed to get 1 year's average rainfall across 6 years. So, you know, we're hoping that the gaps start to fill in soon.
Well, it's certainly going to be a tough Christmas by the sounds of it for many farming families across Queensland. But I did see this really lovely story online about a group of ladies who've started up a Facebook page called Ladies of the Land, and they're hoping to send out 1,000 care packages a day to women in drought-affected areas and trying to get them out before Christmas. And I was reading they've already sent out 7,000. They want to get out another 10,000. Have you heard similar sorts of offers of generosity?
Oh, it's just so lovely to hear those things. And I guess that's maybe a bit of the silver lining, if there is such a thing, when you know, times get so tough, really brings out the best in people. And often in the bush, you'd be the same. You know, how often do we talk to farmers and they just want people to understand their situation? And when you see gifts and this sort of generosity, it makes them feel like people care. And I think that's really important. Of course, we've been seeing this since 2013, when the drought started in parts of Queensland, this sort of generosity, whether it's care packages or donated hay, all of those sorts of things. I guess the most popular thing in Queensland has been full cash gift cards, because, you know, then you can go and spend that money in your local community. As we know, the drought doesn't only affect farmers, it affects the whole community. So, you know, every day I feel like we're hearing these lovely stories, and it is lovely, absolutely. And, you know, but hopefully there's not a need for it soon.
Lydia, thanks for filling us in and giving us that picture of what's going on in Queensland right now after, well, some got some rain overnight anyway. Good to catch up with you.
It's always a pleasure.
Lydia Burton is the rural reporter in Toowoomba, and it is 11 minutes to 1.
You're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
So good to have you along this afternoon. Researchers at the University of Western Australia believe they are a step closer to developing wheat with improved tolerance to the herbicide metribuzin,
which will give grain growers more weed control options. Hackett Professor Kadambot Sadiq led a team of researchers that's identified key genes in wheat which can be used to develop new and improved wheat varieties. He says their work should lead to the development of herbicide-tolerant wheat that will improve weed management and hopefully crop yield.
Some of the herbicides, when we apply, it not only kills the weeds but also affects the wheat and hence leads to some reduction in yield. So it's important to look at wheat tolerant to some of the common herbicides so that minimal damage is done while we are applying herbicides.
So just looking back, it was in about 2004 that Eagle Rock was released, and that was bred by Enterprise Grains Australia. So it has a tolerance to metribuzin to some degree. Are you looking to enhance that tolerance? Is that the key point of difference here?
So if you look at the Australian wheat varieties, as you rightly pointed out, Eagle Rock and Blade are relatively tolerant to metribuzin when compared with other varieties. But still it is causing some yield reduction when you apply the herbicide. So we looked at 946 wheat genotypes as part of a PhD project done by Rupali. And then we developed a system where we can apply the metribuzin as a pre-emergent post-sowing herbicide and rapidly screen that through a system we have developed here. And from those 946 wheat genotype, we have identified several which are significantly tolerant than Eagle Rock. So we used Eagle Rock Blade as a benchmark. But the susceptible ones are, highly susceptible ones are Spear and Dagger, again two Australian wheat cultivars. So from there we selected seven genotypes with different levels of tolerance compared with Eagle Rock and Blade, and then developed a crossing program.
My goodness, and how long did that project take?
So we are really lucky in the sense that, of course, we have a hard-working and an intelligent PhD student, but Professor Gujin Yan, my colleague, and his team has developed what we call rapid generation technique, where we can generate up to 7 to 8 generations of wheat per year. So normally, when you do these kind of studies, it can take up to 5 to 7 years to get a stable genotype. So with that technique, we were able to fast-track the crosses and their lines and screen rapidly in the system we have developed and then make them homozygous, means stable. So we were able to do the genetics and other studies from the progeny.
And you've identified these key genes that are associated with metribuzin tolerance. Where to from here? When might this work translate into a variety for growers to be putting into the ground?
So we have already collaboration with companies like Intergrain, wheat breeding company, and based on an agreement, we are happy to transfer those materials to the who is interested, and then they can then use in their breeding program and back cross with our current varieties, and then get those genes into new varieties. So I think it is pretty close. So it's a matter of then working with the breeding companies and moving. So university is not set up for breeding and taking into the commercial operation, but there are several of them in Australia. But it is an exciting discovery in terms of the key genes and their mechanism, how it is there, and so it will lead to improved varieties.
That is Kadambot Sadiq catching up with reporter Joe Prendergast. 7 minutes to one here on the Country Hour, and shortly getting the details of the Boyanup cattle sale that was held yesterday. John Testrow with those details shortly. With the high rate of shearers being injured on the job, a team of researchers is using new technology to try and prevent the injuries occurring. The researchers are from the University of Melbourne and have been working with a group of shearers in Victoria and in New South Wales, just trying to determine how much of an impact muscle fatigue
is having on shearers' lower backs. Tim Fuchs with this report.
If you are a shearer in Australia, you are six times more likely to suffer an injury on the job compared to other workers. A team of researchers at the University of Melbourne is using sensors and motion tracking systems to monitor the movements of shearers, looking at the amount of pressure placed on their bodies, which are often in a stooped position for hours every day. Mark Robinson is working towards a PhD in physical human robot interaction and is working on the trial.
So the sensors get placed on the skin directly over the top of muscles that we know to be important. So especially around the lower back and the upper legs. The motion capture system is another set of sensors which has to be placed basically on each joint segment. So all over the body, basically, for the motion capture sensors.
What have you found out?
We're really noticing that muscle fatigue in those back muscles that are important for that continued safe movement. We notice that fatigue building up over the day and even further into the week as well. So it builds up over the week. And we're also noticing, basically, their changing movement on that front as well. So over towards the end of the day, they're using different muscles and moving differently.
Mark Robinson is confident the research, which is in its early days, may come up with solutions to prevent shearers suffering from such high rates of injury.
Maybe perhaps we could challenge the idea that they'd basically shear in four runs over the course of the day of 2 hours each. It perhaps is better to have, you know, a shorter work period and shorter breaks that occur more often. And we're also noticing that, I guess, traditionally in the industry, they would shear the rams at the end of the week, which is the bigger sheep that obviously put a lot more pressure on their bodies. And maybe it's not a good idea to shear these at the end of the week, you know, while that fatigue is at its worst.
The research has been supported by Australian Wool Innovation, which has been finding shearers to volunteer in the trial. AWI's General Manager of Research, Jane Littlejohn, welcomes the focus on injuries suffered by shearers and believes it could shake up the average working day in the shearing shed.
Let's imagine every shearer is wearing a device that tells them, oh, you've reached that stress threshold, you need to rest that muscle, you need to rest. Now, whether that means that the traditional smoko, has to change and be customised to the rest period for every individual shearer, I don't know. The other part that could be in form is a device that supports the shearer, wears it like an exoskeleton, and that device supports the shearer because it's tuned into the signals, the fatigue signals in the muscle, and it sort of commences some sort of extra force on the body that takes that stress off the shearer. Who knows? They could be wearing exoskeletons. They could be bringing their overhead gear or their gear with them, as well as their exoskeleton. Who knows what the future is like?
AWI's General Manager of Research, Jane Littlejohn, with Tim Fuchs. 3 minutes to one. Just a few moments ago, you heard from Lydia Burton, the ABC's rural reporter in Toowoomba, just talking about the bit of rain that has fallen in some parts that really need it, obviously in Queensland, drought parts of Queensland. And you heard from a grower, a Rosella grower, in, I think it was around Gympie. And Liz at Gero is asking, what the hell are Rosella plants? Well, let me tell you, it did feature on Landline last year, and it's an edible hibiscus that's best known in Australia as the main ingredient for a delicious jam. Just do a search. Just search ABC Rural and Rosella, and you'll find Jennifer Nichols' story on Rosella, and it shows what the plant, what the flowers, and what the jam looks like. Check it out on ABC Rural, Rosella, and that search should get you there. It is 2 minutes to one to the markets now, and there was a cattle sale at Boyanup yesterday. John Testrow was there. John, how did it go?
Good afternoon, Bill. The fifth in the series of the annual Boyanup Weaner Briefbred Cattle Sales was held yesterday, and that's where all cattle are presented for sale weaned a minimum of 10 days. Buyers in attendance were southwestern graziers, feedlotters and live export operators. Quality of the offering was again outstanding, and the buyers showed their liking for this format. The weaned cattle were 10 cents dearer than last week's sale and 25 to 30 cents dearer than weaner cattle offered in trade sales over the previous 2 days at both Mushay and Boyanup selling centres. Angus cattle were the dominant breed, and many graziers and feedlotters were repeat buyers of these. Live exporters mainly operated on the Euro and Eurocross cattle, and with their support came a strong contribution to the success of the sale. The winner steers, all breeds, sold from 254 to 348 to average 314. That's up 10 cents on the winner sale last week. The winner heifer selling from 220 to 292 to average 252, also up 10 cents. Quite a successful sale, especially considering the thousands of winner cattle sold over the last few weeks. That's all from me for today. This has been John Testrow for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service and the ABC.
John, thank you for going through those details. Tomorrow, a couple more market wraps for you, going through the results of the two-day Mount Barker cattle market and also a wrap of the wool mark. But exciting times now. Off to Perth Stadium with you now for the cricket test between Australia and New Zealand. They've just had a minute's silence for the victims of the White Island volcano eruption and the national anthems. Australia won the toss and decided to bat, and play is just about to start. So let's join commentators Jim Maxwell and Mitchell Johnson.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.